Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com.
Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, and I'm joined today by Caroline Millingdon, who has come to tell us all about her new book, Kindfulness. Caroline, thank you so much for coming in to speak to
us. You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Not at all. I'd like to start by talking a bit about you. I'm probably going to make your ears burn a bit here. But you're an award-winning journalist, and you're currently a digital producer for the ITV show Loose Women, which is, of course, massively popular. And in 2017, you were responsible for growing visitors to Loose Women's website by 134%, while digital video views increased by 69%. And I'm not just reading off stats for no reason, because I think a massive part of your job has been interacting with, obviously, digital content.
Yes.
And social media.
Yes.
And that's something we're going to come on to, because that feeds a great deal into your book.
Yes, it does. It's strange because I changed my career from print to digital, but had been immersed in the digital aspect before. Was a really early adopter of social media back in the day when they all started. So I used it in my personal life and then introduced it on several brands I worked in print. So it's a big aspect, I guess, of my life, which I've now created a career out of. But I just think there's a huge impact it has on people's everyday lives as well, which is what I touch on in the book.
And is absolutely necessary, because I'm 23 and I know exactly how much social media can impact young people's lives.
Turn your notifications off.
I do.
Yay.
I don't even have the Facebook app or anything on my phone now.
Oh, that's good.
But I was struck recently because I've started working as a tutor for 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds.
And
I cannot believe how much in the last 8 years since I was 15, their use of social media is.
I think this is the issue. When social media first started for me, it was MySpace. And it was really, like, going back, showing my age, really going back, and it was like MySpace and it was fun. And then my friend was like, you need to get on this new thing called Facebook. And I was like, well, that's not going to take off. So I was on Facebook really early. And then I was on Twitter early. I've sort of dabbled in Snapchat, but I really am too old for that, really. Like, it was nice to mess around on, but that's not where my peers were. So it's like, find your audience. Where are my friends? And then Instagram, which for me is the one that's really kind of developed and is the kind of sister of the social media family, I find. There's the audiences and where people go and what people choose to connect with and who they speak to. It's terrifying. I think it's also glorious. I think you have to see both sides to it, because in a way social media gets such bad press because there's, you know, it's terrible online bullying, the comparisons, the self-worth, it all gets wrapped up in them. But for me, it's taking responsibility of who you follow and who you connect with. So my Twitter account, I love, because I'm following awesome people. I get a lot of news from Twitter. For me, there's a lot of empowerment on there.
What would you say to the argument that, I first of all agree that you should, I've cleansed my Instagram, the people I follow.
Yes.
Of accounts that probably led me to be quite jealous or to draw comparisons and everything that feeds into feeling worse about your own life.
Yes.
But with Twitter especially, I'm interested because I don't use Twitter personally.
Right.
I use it through a radio station account that I used to run. And they probably can still see that I still log in to check on people I'm interested in. But do you ever fear you're going to be caught in an echo chamber of people you're too similar to? And do you think that it's worth opening up your feed to people you disagree with? To foster conversation?
I completely get that. I choose not to follow hardcore right-wing people because I think you can immerse yourself and you end up all going, yeah, we're right, and you don't ever see or hear anyone else's opinions or the other side, which I think is really important to know what everyone's politics are and what everybody's saying, even if it just means reinforcing your own beliefs. The thing with Twitter, I guess you do see content shared and retweets. I think because I am very well read and read a lot of other media, I get that from the news, I get that from newspapers. So I think if you're only on social media and you're only choosing to follow people with the same view as you, you're never going to look outside that. You're never going to expand your horizons. You're never going to be challenged in your beliefs. So, which is really important, I think, for everybody at any age, any background, to always reassess every few years of like, well, do I still believe in that? People's political views change, people's social views change, and that's fine, and we should be doing that. And if you are in an echo chamber and we're all like, well, we're right and they're wrong, that's never going to happen. So if you're only on social media and you don't get your media or the views of the world from any other source of media, yes, it's dangerous. But I think if you educate yourself and read different newspapers with different political views, different websites, and are on social media, you're more of a round, well-rounded person.
I think that's a great answer. And I also think if you want your patience tried, you can always just turn on ITV and see Piers Morgan.
Yay, I love Piers. I don't agree with Piers, so I'm caveating with much of what he says. For all. The kiss.
With the kiss, yes. And the partners and whatever, and there's been a cheating, and she defended them, I think, 2 days ago in some sense, and has now since said, actually, there have been developments and I'm changing my point of view.
Which is such strength of character.
Which is such strength of character.
I have a massive girl crush on Susanna Reid, and I don't care who knows it. I think she's just an incredible human being. To work next to Piers Morgan, to come out on top all the time,
exactly.
And to be a true feminist and unapologetic in her viewpoint, but still have such respect for Piers.
And it's
easy brilliant.
For the public to lampoon these public figures who make one comment as either being a polarised evil or good person. And I agree, strength of character is a great way of
describing. It's interesting with social media as well, because you will often make a statement and the, I guess, not fear, but danger of things like Twitter is you can go back like 5 years and go, well, hang on a minute, you're contradicting yourself, you're a hypocrite. But we all change opinions, we all learn. Well, we should be. If we're not, then it's a life half led. So I think to be able to turn around and say, actually, I've changed my opinion on that, or I made that statement 2 years ago and I've had experience in my life that has opened my eyes up to other things, and I'm gonna change my mind on that.
I think one of the most interesting examples of that, and a very current one, is Lily Allen's new autobiography.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I have been sitting down in Waterstones to read in chunks.
I think she's really not turned things around, but she's, I guess, used her personal platform to set the record straight on so many things. And
but how brave,
I know,
to say I got
to do
that so
Lena
wrong.
Dunham, I think, has done it, and I can't remember what, but she's also turned around and said, do you know what, I said this and I was wrong. And for me, whenever I see someone on social media say, actually, I was wrong, and I, you know, hands up, I've changed my mind, or people have been on here and educated me and I was misinformed, I misspoke, I have so much more respect for those people than those that will just continue arguing or just scurry away. Because it's
scurry away and sort of delete or rewrite or reword earlier statements.
Or make excuses without taking on that responsibility of, I misspoke and I was actually wrong, and I've gone away and I've learned more about the subject matter, and this is what I'm doing now, and I will continue to educate myself.
Which is exactly what Lily Allen said about the incident where she released a music video as obviously a white woman herself, with 10 backing dancers who are
people of colour,
slightly sidetracked by that, but that's great. The book, your book is called Kindfulness, and it's about, in your words, being conscious, aware and accepting of one's feelings while demonstrating kindfulness and consideration towards oneself. The quality of being mindfully kind towards oneself and generous with self-compassion. So that's your definition of kindfulness, which, as predictably, was a hybrid of mindfulness and kindness, which is great. Having read the book, that's clearly a state of mind that you had to work to achieve.
Yes, very much so.
What catalysed your recognition that something needed to change?
I think back in 2016, I touched on it at the beginning of the book, I was feeling really low. I kind of described it as feeling really discombobulated, where so much is going right in your life. And I think so many people go through this where, but you can't put your finger on, you're not happy. Like, so you're chasing things and you can't quite get it. I experienced depression when I was at university and had some counselling then. So I was always self-aware when it came to mental health. And back in 2016, I was unhappy. It wasn't enough for me to be like, okay, this is depression. But I thought, if I don't start taking care of my mental well-being and emotional well-being, this is, you know, I can go in that direction. And I spoke to a group of friends and one of them said, well, I've had this amazing therapist. So I went to therapy and I remember the first day I went in and sat down, I was like, there's no, ask me anything. I said, and there's no big thing to fix. Like, I wasn't going with, not that you should have to have a trauma or something terrible happen, but I just wasn't happy and I was so frustrated with that.
I think often if having experienced forms of therapy myself, I think often you want there to be, not you don't want to have experienced a bigger trauma.
Something to fix.
But you want to unpick or unpack something that might contribute to the way you're feeling.
Exactly.
And often one of the scariest things is if you're saying, right, on paper, my life looks great. Why do I feel this way?
Exactly. So I went and really it was the unravelling of myself. That sounds so random. But sort of picking away, looking at my life and where my frustration was or what triggered bits of anxiety. And I realised different behavioural patterns. So I never really thought I experienced anxiety. And then I realised I did. And that did manifest itself sort of physically in the last couple of years that I've had short bouts. I've never had a panic attack. I want to say I'm really lucky. Mental health isn't really luck, but I've definitely experienced anxiety, but I know what it is now. I, you know, watch my moods. Really, I just decided to take responsibility for my happiness. So that's why I went to therapy. That's why I decided to look at my life and how I was choosing to live it and begin to make changes that weren't scary and that were brilliant. And that's where kindfulness was born.
Well, I think the term unravelling makes a lot of sense because it is exactly that. It's hundreds of little strings that kind of hold your life together, and it's picking through those and seeing what could I change.
Yeah. Change and tweak. Exactly. Sometimes it's not dramatic. And the book itself, I think, none of it's dramatic. We don't have to do, you don't have to pack up and sell your house and travel around the world to find happiness. You don't have to go and have this amazingly perfect, you know, relationship or go and get that promotion at job, you know, at work necessarily. None of those will equate happiness if you haven't found it yourself.
Absolutely. I want to now, and you'll see why I'm looking at my notes in
That's
a second,
okay.
Because I did an exercise before I read your book.
Oh, wow.
Where, no, it's honestly, it was the most primitive mind map in the world.
Oh.
It's nothing glamorous, but I was having a think about the term mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And as someone who uses social media and as someone who has just left university at a time when mental health crises for students is at its highest, I actually went to university in Bristol where the suicide rate in the last 2 years has been colossal, and we've had journalists coming down. It has been tragic, and I'm very fortunate not to have known any of the individuals, but the press and the interest in Bristol, which is just part of obviously a widespread problem, I think means, thankfully for the first time, as someone who went to a school where I did not know anything about mental health when I left, except for depression being quite an abstract concept to describe people I would never meet.
Yeah.
And maybe having heard one rumour about a girl 4 years older than me who was carted off by men in white straight
kids. Or old women who were, she suffers with her nerves.
Yeah.
That was an old, you know, terminology. It was, definitely.
So going to university and realising that this, and obviously it's not isolated to university, but that mental health was something I was going to come in contact with and would one day be affected by myself.
Mm-hmm.
It is exciting that mindfulness and well-being and mental health are being spoken about a lot more in mainstream media. But I think there's a point where for many people, and especially those engaging with social media, we are constantly being inundated with advice, and often it feels like orders on how we should be living our life. So, yep. And when it comes through social media, and often you're being told not to be using social media, yep. That's quite conflicting, which is why it was encouraging to read it in a book format when I read Kindfulness. And on learning the premise of your book, I had a quick brainstorm as to what the concept of mindfulness meant to me. And I think I wrote down yoga, exercise, meditation, mm-hmm. regular detoxes, and that means alcohol and social media.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the kind of things that came to mind. And I mean, actually, I just finished Daisy Buchanan's book, and yeah. one of her things which I loved was the sort of mindful art of washing your hair.
Yes.
And that's something I'm trying to do more, because it's just a simple thing. Not trying to do more as in wash my hair more, but as in the taking
take 10
the time
minutes
to yeah. really think about not rushing your early morning routine or giving mm-hmm. yourself more time or whatever. And you yourself wrote that while self-care is so much more than a bubble bath or having a glass of wine, self-care is whatever makes you happy and content. And yet on picking up the book, we're presented with a list of 10 bullet points, and these are presumably designed to work for every person. So I was interested how you remedied the idea that mindfulness can be so different for so many people mm-hmm. or mean different things. And yet you've quite amazingly come up with 10 quite practical commandments that are designed to work for every person.
I guess the commandments are an overview or a guide of what I feel everybody deserves. So I do say in the book, I hate those self-help books that dictate this is what you should do and this is how you will feel. For me, that they're often wonderful and they will raise questions and make you think, and that's brilliant. But I say in Kindfulness, this is not a quick fix and this is not for everyone, and there will be chapters that don't even apply to your life, or it's a pick and mix. You take away from it what you want. And I do think saying to people, spend some more time doing what you love and with the people who make you feel good, is if that's all you take away from the book, that's brilliant and that's enough.
That's not an unhelpful guideline.
No,
exactly.
So it is very much as well, I'm not dictating what will make you happy, because what people's idea of a perfect life, everybody's is completely different. And going back to social media, that's where that's scary, because we compare our lives to the highlights reel of somebody else, and we never know what's happening in real life. We never know the smoke, you know, the smoke and mirrors of social media is so dangerous.
And it's consuming.
Very much so. So I think the commandments for me were just this is an overview. This is what I felt everybody should want to feel, or just be kind to themselves in aspects. But there's no, for me, I would never say to somebody, this is the golden ticket, stop drinking and you will be happy, or get married to the person you're with and you will be happy, or have children or don't have. I'm not the expert on your life. It's a guide to make you the expert on what makes you happy.
And I think the beauty of the book is that when you read it, you don't at all feel like you're being preached to. You feel privileged. No, not at all. I mean, you feel privileged to be able to gain so much insight into one person's experience, and someone who's had the time to write it all down and make it into a sort of, it's not a comprehensive guide, it's a comprehensive story about how those
yes.
changes or tweaks you made helped you.
And I hope I make it very clear, because a number of times I reference, I'm still working on this, I'm still trying to do this.
Which is encouraging.
And every day there's no get to the end of the book and I'm like, P.S. I'm so smug, my life's perfect, I lived happily ever after. That's not the case. I am, and I stand by, and I've said I'm the happiest I've ever been, and I stand by that. But every day I mess up or I forget to do things. I haven't meditated in ages. It's something I need to remind myself to do. It's more I stop myself from beating myself up about the things I'm not getting 10 out of 10 on, because that's okay, because that's life.
Can I quickly go back to your smoke and mirrors
yes.
comment on social media, which is something I think a lot of people mm-hmm. understand and can relate to. What would your advice be to someone who's, and I realise we just said these aren't guidelines, but just general advice to someone who's trying to cut down, maybe they feel that their relationship with social media is unhealthy, mm-hmm. they think it's consuming, and they think they, or maybe it's someone close to them, are investing too much in the lives of other people, maybe, or are following unhealthy accounts, for mm-hmm. want of a better
I think
word.
if it's you, the first thing to do is see how much time you spend on it, because firstly, when I don't have any push notifications on my phone, not for work accounts, personal accounts. I have text and WhatsApp, and that's it, because for me, that's those are messages coming directly to me, but nothing on social media.
Does that cut you scrolling?
Yes,
because you think every time you open the app, there's the temptation to scroll.
It's really important for people to decide when they choose to go on social media, not let accounts dictate to them and flag them and buzz them and pop up, because you will be pulled into that straight away. So my first thing is turn your notifications off and be aware of how much time, because I know I'm guilty of, I'll wake up, I'll just check social media, and then half an hour later, I'm running late for work because I've been so busy clicking through to read news, clicking through, liking, seeing stuff, and there's just too many layers to it.
And that can then set your frame of mind for the rest of the day.
Exactly, because then you're late and you're like, oh, and then you're just like, I'm rubbish. I've just been looking at a Kardashian, or I've just been reading what Lily Allen's saying about her book, or I've just watched one of GMB's videos, or what Pierce said this morning, and which is fine to do if you're maybe on the train on the way to work or on the bus, but not when you're still lying in bed. So this is something I do, and I have to catch myself and be like, don't do that. The other thing I would say is check in with your mood after being on social media. If you spend an hour, which is very easy to do on Instagram once you've gone through stories and watched live, and you come away going, oh, I haven't got a cat, and I can't do that makeup tutorial, and I haven't, how have they read 5 books this week when they've got kids? Like, all these things, like, how have they got, why do they look so good at that? And then there's the Fitspo, and then there's the clothes, and then there's the holiday with the sausage legs, and there's just so much. If you come away going, I'm just sat in my flat on my own, and my only company were these people, or some who might be friends and some might be strangers, but these people on Instagram, don't do it, or unfollow certain accounts. If accounts don't inspire you but make you compare yourself, and they don't motivate you, they make you feel crap, don't follow them, because no one's making you follow them.
Yeah, it's so easy.
It's no one's making you be on any social media platform, and no one is saying you must follow this account.
Having said that, I do think there is a pressure to not to share and mm-hmm. not to be on the account, but I do think that the amount people use it, and
it's social currency, it now flows into everyday life. So someone does a tweet, it's then on a website as a story, it'll be in the newspaper the next day, possibly on the news, and if you haven't seen it and your peer group are talking about this story,
you
miss out. So I do completely get the FOMO,
but I think,
if it's relevant, it will come to you. Like, my sister she did her first Facebook post ever last week to congratulate me on my book. She hasn't got time for it. She's married, she's a teacher, she's got 2 kids. She doesn't have time, and it's not a priority. So if you look at your priorities when it comes to spending time on social media, and priority of yourself and how it makes you feel, what's better to go, no, I didn't see that tweet because I was really busy doing something far more important, like living my life, or I was having dinner. That doesn't matter. You shouldn't fear missing out on some social media when you should be having an amazing time reading a brilliant book or watching a brilliant drama on TV or seeing friends in real life.
I think those turning off push notifications, mm-hmm. cleansing who you follow from unhealthy accounts are great ways to get yourself to a place of happiness like you have. I'm interested now in your life. I was about to say post your happiest phase, but I mean right now.
Yeah.
And how you find it interacting with people who you see as, and not in a patronising way, but as a step behind you. Because I was listening to a podcast the other day. It was Elizabeth Day's How to Fail series. Yes. I think she was talking to Dolly Alderton, and Dolly Alderton was talking about her relationship with herself and maybe her self-worth. And I think it was in a romantic aspect that she said she'd finally got to a place where she felt she... And she'd worked really, really hard to get there. And she felt she finally knew what she wanted from a relationship and how to police herself from bad habits, which meant that that had maybe left her vulnerable in the past. And she then decided to take a break from dating, and she went back to it after a year or two. I'm paraphrasing, so I hope I'm getting this correct. But the first two men that she happened to date, and this is obviously not indicative of all men, but let her down because they weren't on the same page as her. And so she said it was really difficult when, for her life, she was able to kind of go through and analyse it and say, right, I'm at a really, really good place. And she'd been through therapy, and she thought, this is how I'm going to use my life. And then to be let down by someone who maybe...
Yeah, you make a make a plan, or you think you've got it sorted, and then life comes along and kicks up the arse.
So how do you remedy that with the sort of every real life? Do you
it's a really big question. Yes, all the time. This is I think you can honestly be happy and still have to remind yourself it's okay to still want to self-improve or look at your life and be like, oh gosh, they've got that. What do I do with that? Do I sit in jealousy, sit in resentment, or instead do a mental list of what I have got? It's ironic because you talk about Daisy earlier, and I was listening to the podcast and I was like, oh, she's married. And she's like in her early 30s and she's got everything sorted. And I completely did because the whole thing with confidence is like you can't actually stop any comparisons, but you can realise you're doing it. And that's my thing. So
that's self-awareness.
Exactly. So I was like, oh, that good for you being all happy and you've got your book out. And it's because for me on paper, and this is the thing, but on paper when you're comparing, I'm sat there and I'm like, okay, well, this is incredible. I've had my first book published and it's brilliant and I couldn't be prouder, and I'm 40. So then I'm like, oh, they did it a decade before. And then it's like, oh, and then, but then as soon as I have that thought, for me, I was like, that's so mean. Because this is still a huge achievement.
I think a part of that is internalised misogyny. Oh, we're programmed to be jealous.
Completely. And there's nothing...
And it's awful.
There's kind of nothing wrong with it when it motivates you or makes you then say, stop, I'm going to actually go, but hold on, I've achieved X, Y, Z in the last 10 years instead of writing the book. So... I gave myself a little wry smile that I was doing the comparison of someone else's success. And it wasn't about being jealous of Daisy or anybody else. It was beating myself up because I hadn't got there earlier.
And that's not kindness.
And that's not kindness. So, but for me, it's kind of, so you don't actually stop any of it happening, but you realise what you've done.
Which is the best first step. Which
completely. And I think this is the thing. We are programmed to want everything or to have it all, and I don't believe that's quite possible because you're knackered and it's difficult. I'm single at 40. I didn't think I would be single at 40. I thought I'd be married with children. That hasn't happened yet. You never know. Hopefully, fingers crossed. And I had a conversation with my niece Eliza, who's 5, at the weekend. We'd gone to see my godchildren and I was driving her home, and I can't remember how it came about, but she's in the back and she's like, oh, because you don't have children of your own, do you, Auntie Caroline? And I said, no, I don't. And then for me, it's really important to show the children in my life you can be happy and single. And When I was growing up, adults got married and had children and that was it. And now, myself and my peers, some are married, some are not. Some have got children and not married. Some are married and don't want children. everybody's happy in their own way. And I think it's really important to sort of present that as an option. So I said, oh, well, maybe I won't have any children, but, you know, maybe I will one day. And she said, no, but it's nice because you like the, because you have the peace and quiet. And I don't know if my sister had been like, oh, I just wish I had some peace and quiet, or, oh, it's all right for Auntie Caroline, she's got peace and quiet. And I said, oh, I do, I live on my own, but I'm very happy. And she's like, yes. And I said, do you think, you know, but maybe I will meet someone and like live with a man. And she said, maybe, but then, you know, you want your peace and quiet. So I'm like, I have my peace and quiet. But it's so sweet through the eyes of children.
Yeah.
But I also think it's really important to show them that life isn't just, love is so important, don't get me wrong, and being in a really happy, healthy relationship. But there's also life with people who aren't in a relationship and they can be happy. So it was just so sweet. It's Caroline, you've got your peace and quiet.
I wanted to talk a bit now about one of your chapters. It's actually the chapter called Making Changes.
Yeah.
And a subtitle is Procrastinator or Perfectionist.
Oh, lordy, yeah.
Let's get into the deep stuff. So you describe your old habit of delaying areas of your life out of fear of failure. And you write of procrastinating when it came to dating, weight loss, going for promotions, or changing jobs, and not because I wasn't motivated or didn't have the desire, but because I was scared of failing. I think it's an incredibly common, almost a knee-jerk reaction when we're scared of something to take ourselves out of the race before the starting line, because then it's much easier to say, I never wanted that anyway.
Yes.
And you risk having to swallow your pride and saying I failed, than to take the plunge when it comes to a lot of the things you mentioned in that quotation. So I'm interested in how you think society's current need for instant gratification plays into this. Do you think one of the reasons you feared failure in those areas is because you felt that in a way your pursuit of, for example, something like weight loss, your fear was because we're used to achieving instant gratification with things like Instagram likes, and so therefore you might be harder on yourself because with things that take time to see progress, I often find myself frustrated because I know that for so many things I get instant likes or instant feedback, and a lot of that is fostered through social media.
I think weight loss was probably partly to do with that. I think it's also a lot to do with self-worth and self-esteem, so it's probably a bigger conversation to have. And it's interesting because it's something I am working on. I talk about, well, tangents, like the kindfulness diet, which is basically don't go on a diet.
Which is the only way to break.
But
sort of diet and
it's interesting when it comes to weight loss or body image. For me, I've always been caught up in how can you have high self-esteem and love your body when you want to change it? So if you're plus size like I am and go, well, I want to lose weight, I'd love to be healthy, I'd love to drop a couple of dress sizes and be healthy and look good and feel good, but I love myself. It's such a contradiction and a really difficult thing to get your head round.
I totally understand what you mean. And I think it's really difficult when it comes to things like exercise.
Yeah.
Because as someone who's struggled with body image, which I think most young women have.
Yeah, of course.
And I was talking about this yesterday with a friend who's incredibly sporty, and she always has been. And she's probably the only person I know I can actually call an athlete. She's very, very successful in sports, and so she doesn't understand, I don't think, the relationship I have with exercise, which is that if I'm in the gym and I do any form of exercise and then I think, okay, well, actually I'm feeling, I've got a lot of energy, maybe I'll push myself today and do another 20 minutes, and then instantly a voice in my head goes, no, you don't want to do 20 minutes, you want to go home. And then I'm thinking, okay, well, I can't go back on that voice because then I'm not honouring my commitment not to ever exercise, and I don't want to. And I not to punish myself with exercise.
We have very, as women, but also men, have very complicated relationships with our bodies. Social media tells us what we're supposed to look like, and none of us do, because it's impossible most of the time without a heavy filter. I think, for me, I began losing some weight at the beginning of this year because I was simply kinder to myself. And that sounds so wishy-washy and ridiculous, but I was just wanted to eat healthier, and I stopped drinking so much, which I talk about in the book. I do drink, but I've cut back dramatically, and it was something I wanted to do for health. I would still like to lose weight, but that's for, it is health and aesthetics.
So it's on your own
But it's on my own terms, and I'm terrible. I guess it's procrastination as well. Like, if someone tells me to do something, I will not want to do it. So even if I have to kind of trick myself into doing things. But I recently actually got a personal trainer, which also kind of feels like a strange betrayal of...
No, I know not exactly that,
not
what
that
you
I'm
mean.
A, not that I'm some plus-size role model, because I'm really not. But it's really hard to go, I love the person I am, I love the skin I am, I'm proud of my body when I want to change it. But the way in which I'm doing it is so, I can't describe, it's so extraordinary. So my personal trainer is called Hannah, and she only trains women. My friend was working with her and recommended her, and I said, okay, I'll do this. I've done it before. It was horrific. Gyms, I find terrible places to be. I don't know.
They're odd places to be.
Oh, just everyone's either beautiful or fit, because that's why they're there. There's nowhere to go for people who want to be going to the gym but don't know where to start. Yeah. Or I've had a personal trainer before who just showed no interest in me and made me do everything I didn't want to do, which is like running. I don't want to be running. So I started working with Hannah recently. Had a big conversation with her before. I can't get enough of it, and I never in my 40 years thought I'd say I want to see my personal trainer and I'm lifting weights and doing kettlebells and ropes and boxing, and it is the most fun. And the reason I enjoy it is because I feel my body getting stronger. It's not about being thin, it's about strength, and it feels like a treat. So I no longer procrastinate when it comes to working out. And I have to put it down to like Hannah and the motivation. I found the right person. I think it's about finding the right thing for you, whether that's walking or swimming or the gym. It doesn't have to be a personal trainer or tennis with a friend, whatever. But finally, I'm enjoying moving my body because it makes me feel good. But it's what the results will be physically, it's kind of beside the point. And it's the same with the number on the scales and the number in my clothes. That's irrelevant to who I am, and my self-worth isn't wrapped up in that. But moving makes me feel good, so I'm going to continue moving.
It's such a funny one to navigate, and I had the exact same thing. I joined a gym probably only 3 months ago, and I had an induction because, funnily enough, you're not allowed to run wild
on the throwing weights around.
No idea. And the guy who was doing it, first of all, weighed me, which I found terrifying because I haven't weighed myself in 2 years. But it was for them to say, okay, so we can see if you've made progress.
No, I know, but that doesn't necessarily mean progress.
And then they said, and I think he already realised from speaking to me that I, just that maybe he wasn't saying, what do you want to change about your body? But he said, he quite respectfully said, you know, is there anything you really want to work on? And I said, well, I don't know, because I don't know. I don't know. When you said, what do you lift? I didn't know what that meant. And he said, do you want to do a legs day? And I said, why would I come in and do a whole day of legs? Is that like a 9-to-5 thing? And he went, no, it means you just work on your legs one day. And I was like, no, of course I don't want to work on one part of my body. My whole body is fine. What do you mean? And it just took time working out that it's not a kind of project where you go in and say
no. I think there's a lot of dangers around the fitness industry. I think when you see the Fitspo things going on Instagram and the diets and legs day, arms day, every day. Like, I just, it's not what people actually need to do.
But it might be for some people. I think we should remember that because it, I don't think it's not for me.
But I think for a lot of people, everything's so intimidating, those aspects, going, what do you want to do that's going to make you feel great?
Yeah.
Because it's not about what do you want to do that's going to lose an inch because that's going to change your life. It's not.
And like, it might be a case of just finding out what it is. Exactly. Like, I don't like running, and you said you don't like running, but I love swimming.
Yeah.
And so it's trying a few things.
But I do think I've got friends who are personal trainers, and I've got people who are massively into the gym, and that's brilliant. And I'm obviously now working out, and I love it. So I'm all endorsing it. But I think you have to find what's right for you. And the conversation should be around, what do you want to do that's going to make you feel good? What's the kind of exercise you do? So for me, it's like not getting bored doing one thing and changing things up. And but we should be going to the gym to feel good about our bodies and our minds. And whether you end up looking like you, but firmer because you've been working out, that might be perfection. It's not about coming out a year later, you know, 5 sizes smaller. That doesn't actually change everything if you're still not happy with your body, if that makes sense.
Great message. Finally, I wanted to ask you a bit about, well, not specifically therapy, because mm-hmm. you do touch on it in the book, and you describe it as an act of self-compassion. But it was more, I wanted to talk more about options available that you'd recommend, because I know you would recommend some apps and things,
mm-hmm.
and obviously the whole book is basically recommending how you can improve your well-being and your kindfulness. But I wanted to ask, because therapy is something that to a lot of people, for obvious reasons, will seem like a privilege that's not necessarily accessible. What would you recommend to someone who wants to seek help but doesn't necessarily have the means of enabling that? And are there ways, I mean, I know you recommend things like Headspace.
Yeah.
What would you recommend?
I think,
as a starting point for someone who doesn't know much about therapy and maybe is a bit skeptical.
Yeah, I think therapy probably isn't for everybody and isn't needed by everyone either. Sometimes it's giving yourself that headspace to go away and think about what you want and talking with friends. So I was in a position where I decided to invest in therapy. I was lucky enough to be able to afford that. So, or made it a priority rather than could just afford it. I think starting to do things like meditation and the apps is a really good place to see how that is. If your mind's running wild, if you have anxiety or worry, taking 10 minutes out or whenever you're commuting or in the bath or before you go to bed, definitely things like Headspace are really good as a series of learning to calm the mind, and breathing is so important. I'm not a mental health expert, obviously. But if anyone is worried about feeling low for long periods of time or experiencing depression, which, as we've said, it will either impact on your life or definitely someone you know, because I think it's at least 1 in 4 of us in our lifetime will experience a mental health issue. If you're in a place of work, I would maybe see if there's support in the workplace, because it is something companies are taking on now to provide that as a support, whether it's HR or occupational health. Often there are courses now as well on mental health and meditation, so definitely speak to workplace to get that support. I think there are barriers being broken down, as well as if you're at work and have a mental health issue, people don't just dismiss it or see it as stress, as being a sign of weakness of character, because it certainly is not. For me, I'd also advocate Mind, the mental health charity. They have counselling available. There is helplines available. There's so much information on their website. So I would definitely get in touch with them and see if there was any availability, and also your GP. I think having a conversation with your doctor is super important to get the conversation going. Unfortunately, mental health is so underfunded. I could cry. It's terrible. Obviously, the NHS are incredible and pushed to the limit, but mental health services are very underfunded in this country. So go to your GP. Counselling can work even short term just to kickstart thought processes. I've never taken antidepressants personally. I have friends who do. I think find what works for you. And talk to family and friends. That should be your first port of call, because no one should suffer in silence, even if it's you don't think it's serious. And often I think people underestimate their low mood, or they might say, oh, I'm feeling down. If this is prolonged, if this goes on for weeks, confide in a friend. I know people who have sat in their mental health and hidden it from their nearest and dearest, and it's spiraled out of control, to the point of taking emergency action because they, you know, were going to harm themselves. So I think for me, confiding in someone, never be afraid to speak up, and finding your tribe, because ultimately we, as much as being kind to ourselves, we should be kind to other people and be there and listen and look out for people, whether it's on social media or in real life. Check in with people and make sure that they're okay, even if it's just a text.
Well, wait lists are long, so it's great to know that there are services and networks and people you can go to.
Yeah, definitely.
As a starting point. So Caroline, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, and that's Caroline Millington's book, Kindfulness: How to Be Kinder to Yourself and Find True Happiness, is out as of Thursday last week.
Yes.
And you said earlier, before the interview, that you're just starting to receive feedback, so you can know that we all loved it here at Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you. And for more wonderful women and their work and their interviews, you can visit www.radiogorgeous.co.uk. Thank you.